Welcome once again to the Cleveland Public Library Sports Archives, and our guest today is Doug Deacon, former left tackle of the Browns and a longtime analyst on their radio broadcast. Doug and I are getting together here on April 2nd, 2014. Doug, you're looking pretty good for an old-timer.
Well, somehow you and I should be together on April Fool's Day, but it didn't happen. But you still got your St. Patrick's Day sweater on, so we can understand why.
Missed it by a day. Okay. You joined the Browns 1971, sixth-round draft choice out of the University of Illinois. Tell us about your illustrious career at Illinois, would you?
Well, we were on probation all 4 years I was there. I was too late for the money at Illinois and too early for the money in the NFL. But I'd been recruited by Pete Elliott, one of the great college football coaches, and both my parents had gone there. So yeah, I was Dick Butkus went there, and to me that was what a football player was Dick Butkus. So I signed to go there, and then they were put on probation. They told me I could opt out of my scholarship, and I said no. So I elected to stay and spent 4 years there. You couldn't play as a freshman, but my sophomore year I was a starting wide receiver. We went up and played Notre Dame. It was Jim Seymour and I were the two starting wide receivers. Had to be the two slowest guys that ever started an NCAA game. We got beat 55-8. I'm still trying to figure out why we went for two. But then we, sophomore year we went 1-9. My junior year we went 0-10. My senior year we were 3-7. So
all those years just missed out on going to the Rose Bowl.
Just missed out by about 8 or 9 games. But you know, and I was the same era of the Ohio State national championship team of Tatum, Kern, and all that. So when I got drafted by the Browns, actually my junior and senior year, I got moved from wide receiver to tight end. And then I get a phone call from Nick Skorich one day back in 1971 saying, we just drafted you as an offensive tackle. And I said, there's any chance maybe that I could play tight end? He says, we'll see when you get there. And then he gave me a 73 number, and I said I knew my days as a tight end were over. So I had to make the best of it.
You know, what was the comment that you said to your mother? Said, I was just drafted.
Yeah, I was at home, and it wasn't the big hoopla that it is today. So I was downstairs at the house watching TV, and my mom had her bridge club upstairs. Mm-hmm. And so I get this phone call, and I talked to Nick Skorich. I thought the coach was still Blanton Collier. Yeah. And the only recognition of the Cleveland Browns that I really had was the Gary Collins catching touchdown passes, because that was when I was in high school and I was a wide receiver, and you want to identify with somebody that is good, and Gary Collins was good. So I get the phone call that I'd been drafted in the sixth round. So I go upstairs and I say, hey mom, I just got drafted by the Browns. And she says, oh, that's great, 4 clubs. So that was my indoctrination to it. And so the Browns flew me out to meet the coach. They actually put me in at the Howland House across the street. It took a cab from downtown, got to the Howland House, found a theatrical bar and grill that night. And so after I got done there, the next day I went down to the stadium and I met Nick Skorich, Art Modell, and everybody. And it was kind of a snowy day. And so,
aren't they all at that time of year?
So they had a guy that worked for him named Bernie Harrison, used to do odd jobs. And they said, hey, Bernie, you take the Deacon back to the airport. Well, Bernie just drove me down to the terminal tower and he says, hey, kid, there's a train at the bottom. Take the one going west. When it stops, you get off. You're at the airport. Have a nice trip. So that's basically how my indoctrination to the Browns. And I guess the other part of the story was I was back on campus, and I got a call from Stan Wallace, who had played for the Bears for several years and had a campus bar, and I accidentally ran into him there a few times. And so he called me one day and he says, hey, I want you to come down to the bar. And I said, okay. So I go down there and he says, I got somebody I want you to meet. So I go in, and here's Abe Gibbard, the great Bears, or actually Browns offensive lineman, but also Bears assistant coach at the time. And Abe getting a beer, and he goes, give me a beer. What are they offering you, kid? I told him, give me another beer. Okay. tell me you want this, this, and this, or you're going to get an agent. Give me another beer. And that's how I negotiated my contract. So I went back to the Browns. I said, this is what I want, or I'm going to get an agent. And so I got, you know, the contract.
Oh, boy. Very complicated negotiations,
yes,
back then. So now your first coach then was Nick Skorich.
Nick Skorich, yeah.
Too bad you just missed playing for Blanton Collier. You got to know him, though, I'm sure.
Yeah, I got to know Blanton because Blanton came back when Forrest Gregg was the head coach, and he was the quarterback's coach trying to help Mike Phipps. And he also came back and he coached us during a strike one year when the rookies went and played down in Tampa. We stayed back at Hiram, and Blanton coached us. And, you know, what you'd learn from Blanton in one day was what you usually learn from most coaches in months.
Wow. So Nick Skorich was your first coach. Tell me about your personal impressions of him.
Not a lot of impression. The thing is, you know, he'd been a defensive coach with the Browns prior to that. And he had a different type of relationship with a lot of the players, Hickerson and Shafraff and
the veterans
that, you know, all of a sudden now he was the head coach, and these guys were still trying to treat him like he was the assistant coach. But, you know, I kind of caught the fumes of the 64 championship team. You know, when you look at the Shafraff, yeah, and Hickerson, Leroy Kelly, Gary Collins, so, you know, it was, you know, great to be able to play with some of those guys. And I, being a wide receiver and tight end, the only people I really kind of knew were Frank Ryan and Gary, yeah, Collins.
Yeah.
And I did know who Leroy Kelly was. But as far as, you know, the offensive linemen, I never kept track of them, or, you, yeah, know, didn't get the exposure that you have today. So,
so now this is 1971, Nick's first year as the head coach, although he had once been the head coach of
Philadelphia.
Eagles,
yeah.
Yes.
And
so he had been around a little bit.
And, of course, you know, I was here as a result of that blockbuster trade the Browns made with the Chicago Bears, where he traded Epi Barney for a six-round draft pick, and that turned out to be me.
That Epi Barney, by the way, was a kid from Collinwood High School.
Yeah, and all my buddies still say that the Bears got the better end of it.
So, anyway, what were your expectations? And you made the team as a sixth-round draft choice.
I made the
that
team
was a triumph in itself.
Well, yeah, but you know, prior to making the team, they actually waived me. I got cut by the Browns towards the end of training camp, and the deal was, back then they had Mickey McBride's old taxi squad, so you could put six guys on it, and they could move you up to the regular squad, but they had to use a move. But in order to put you on the taxi squad, you had to clear waivers. So they figured I was a six-round draft pick that was a tight end that was trying to convert to be a tackle. So they figured nobody would pick me up, so they put me on waivers. And the idea was they were going to bring me up to the regular squad at the beginning of the season. Well, when they put me on waivers, what they didn't know was Monty Clark, who had been a tackle here, was a coach down in Miami, and they were trying to get going down there. And he was still friends with some of the guys that he'd played with, Shafraff and Hickerson and Hoagland. And he called me and says, you got any kids that might be worth, you know, us picking up? And so they said, yeah, this kid Deacon. So they claimed me off waivers. Well, the Browns then called him and says, hey, we're either going to, you know, take them off waivers, or you guys withdraw your claim, and then we'll do you a favor down the road. So as it ended up, they withdrew their claim. And so the last two exhibition games, I was on the taxi squad. And then when the regular season started, because I could play special teams, they brought me up, and they put Paul Staroba, who was a third-round draft pick out of Michigan, and they figured somebody would claim him. They used a move to put him on the cap squad.
Okay. Monty Clark, wonderful man. He always wanted to be a head coach in the NFL.
Yeah.
Now, Dick Shafraff, to heighten his concentration, he went to a psychiatrist, Shafraff did. To get about, and he would get booster visits, yeah, about three times. He also had Monty Clark joining him. Anyway, I did it. Shafraff said I couldn't write that story about the psychiatrist until after he retired, because he said quarterback Bill Nelson will just make life miserable for me when he finds out. So I don't write this at all. I wait until Shaf retires. So now Shaf retires. And because he implicates Monty Clark, I called Monty and said, Monty, he was now an assistant coach of somewhere. And he said, can I use you in my story about the psychiatrist? He said, no, please don't. I want to be a head coach in this league. And if I'm implicated in that story, why, people will think that I'm a kook and I'll never get a head coaching job.
Well,
so
yeah.
He wound up getting a head coaching job, not successful.
But when Gene Hickerson was told that Dick was seeing a psychiatrist, and he says, what do you need a psychiatrist? You got to be nuts to play this game anyhow.
Okay, getting back to that starts it. You make the team. By the way, they had to activate you for the start of the season, and now you officially make the team. Wait, wasn't there a story that you kept your clothes in your car because you expected to be cut any day?
I always somebody interviewed me once, and they asked me about making the team, and I said, "Well, yeah, I never really unpacked my car. Actually, I did, but just I thought it'd be better to be humble than be a braggart." So that was my approach to it, and it worked out, as it turns out.
So anyway, you then started for the rest of your 14-year playing career, never missed a game, as you said. You had various knee operations.
Well, I think the irony of the whole thing is, back then, during training camp or preseason, exhibition season, which lasted forever because there was no limit when they could bring you in. In the preseason, I think they kept the veterans in most of the games so that they'd be in shape when the season came around because there was no off-season program. So I probably played three-quarters of those first four exhibition games. And that was all I played. The last two exhibition games, I was on the practice squad. So when the season started, my experience at playing tackle was three quarters. And about the sixth or seventh game, our right tackle, Bob McKay, got hurt. So they said, hey, you only had that one extra tackle. You only had like 40 guys on the roster at the time. They said, you're in for McKay. So I said, okay, I go in and never played right tackle. And I look up and I get Claude Humphrey, who recently went in the Hall of Fame. I said, what are we going to do now? So that's where I started to learn how to hold. But I survived the game, and I remember somebody asked me, they said, well, what do you think? I said, well, the coaches will probably get out of yelling machine with the way I played, but we'll see what happens. So I think we lost a game the next week, and then they decided to make a change in the lineup, and they benched Gary Collins, and they benched Dick Shafraff, and they started Frank Pitts and myself, and that's when I became a starter. So I basically had the two quarters against Atlanta and three quarters in the preseason. So I became a starting tackle in the NFL with five quarters of experience.
Wow. And, you mentioned that you held. Yes, there was a running gag during your entire career here. Doug Holding, number 73. And so tell me about that. There was a method to your madness, wasn't there?
Well, no. I mean, you're getting paid to make sure the quarterback doesn't get hit. And, I always said, playing offensive tackle was like a boxing match. If you started to lose, you turn it into a street fight. And when you turn into a street fight, no holes barred. And I just found that there were these little levers here on the shoulder pads. If you grabbed a hold of, they usually, and by today's standards, I would have not gotten half the holding penalties that I got because, they've, allowed you to do a lot more with your hands than, what they did back then. But, the hold was a big part of my game, as was the leg whip, which is also illegal. And, there was a variety of different things that you did. But I was very fortunate because, when I started, I got to play next to Gene Hickerson. And, here's one of the greatest guards that ever played the game, if not the greatest. And, it was so simple for Gene. I mean, Gene was just an amazing football player, and he had unique training habits. Which non-existent would be probably the best thing, but you put him on the field and there was nobody better.
You once told the story about Hickerson was supposed to pick up some block and...
When they play games, the defensive end and the defensive tackle crisscross, we always picked them up where the guard would grab the first guy and then the tackle would get the second guy, and we're playing the Raiders and Gene lets his guy go and he clobbers me, and I yell at Gene. I said, we used to call him old man. I say, hey, old man, it's guard first man. Yeah. I've got a couple more plays. They run the same stunt. The guy clobbers me again. I said, damn it, old man, it's guard first man. And he looked me right in the eye and he goes, no, guard first choice.
Okay. Your first, let's cover the coaches. Okay. And then let's get back to some other highlights of your association with the Browns. Skorich was the first guy. He gets let go, replaced by Forrest Gregg.
Forrest had been our line coach the year before.
And he was freshly retired from the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah. And, you know, the
Hall of Famer.
And I think if you look at the way the Browns coaching selections have gone, when they fire somebody and rehire somebody or hire the next guy, he's always total opposite, you know, except with the exception of Nick Skorich and Blanton Collier. But it's always been the hard guy, Paul Brown, then the nice guy, Blanton Collier. Nick Skorich was a nice guy. Then you had the hard guy, Forrest Gregg. Then you had the nice guy, Sam Rattigliano. Yeah. And then the hard guy, Marty Schottenheimer. But when Forrest came in, he not only had curfews on Saturday night, the night before the game, he had curfews on Thursday and Friday, too. And, you know, it was...
Why, was that Vince Lombardi's way? Is that what he learned at the Packers?
Well, you know, everything that he did was Vince Lombardi way. But I don't know if that was a total Vince Lombardi thing. So, anyhow, when Forrest got fired, I went over to see him, and I said, Forrest, I got to ask you a question. Why did we have the curfews on Thursday and Friday? He said, well, you remember, I was the offensive line coach before I was the head coach. And I used to sit in those meetings and hear how long you guys were out late night drinking and doing this and doing that. He said, I just figured when I got to be the head coach, I was going to put an end to it. So that's how he did it. But this was prior to cell phones. And what he would do is him and his wife would go by your house or apartment, and they'd look for your car. If it wasn't there, they'd go to the payphone and they call. And if you weren't there, you got fined.
Really?
Yeah.
Gee. He was a tough guy to interview. Like, for a couple of days each week, I would be the guy on the Browns beat for the Plain Dealer, and we would sit, three of us: Hank Kozlowski from a bunch of suburban papers, Bill Scholl from the press, and me. And we would sit there, the four of us. The fourth guy would be Forrest Gregg in his little office up there in Berea. And he wasn't big on chit-chat.
No.
It was tough sitting there. You know, we'd get our football talk out of the way in about 3 minutes. And he didn't do much elaboration and no small talk.
Oh, no. In his... you know, he was a lot like Lombardi. I mean, you know, from the grass drills at practice, where, you know, he actually, one year he filmed the grass drills because he knew the guys in the back row were cheating on the grass drills. They weren't going all the way down. Yeah. So at the meeting that night, he puts his real film on, and here we see the back row of the grass drills, and you see Joe Jones and Walter Johnson, and they're just kind of faking it like they're going down. And, of course, he yelled at Joe Jones, and he was afraid of Walter Johnson, like most people were. But, you know, that was, you know, Forrest's way of getting appointed. And Forrest, you know, he related to the offensive line, but the rest of the football team, some of them, I think he lost.
Okay. He had one of the great lines I've ever heard come out of a football coach's mouth. Remember, I organized an eating contest between the offensive line and the defensive line.
Barry Darrow and Mike St. Clair?
At Jerry Thomas's restaurant at the Sheridan on Center Ridge Road. And it was on Tuesday, whatever your days off were. Yeah, Barry Darrow representing the offensive line and Mike St. Clair representing the defensive line. But everybody was there watching. Steak dinners for everybody, as much as you could eat. And I'll tell you, Mike St. Clair and Barry Darrow gave one great eating performance.
Oh, yeah.
And so the next day, and I wrote a story on it with pictures, but that wasn't going to appear in the paper till the next day. So the next day, the three of us are there with Forrest Gregg in his office, and another one of those lulls in the conversation, Bill Scholl, groping for something to say, says to me, Well, how did the eating contest go last night? And Forrest said, what eating contest? I said, well, we had a little contest between your offensive line and the defensive line. And he said, this was one of the great lines, on who cooked that up?
Well, yeah.
He
yeah.
had no idea that it was such a great line.
We actually went out and played exhibition
game. Oh, by the way, Barry Darrow said when it was all over that night, when Forrest hears about this, he's going to put us through hell tomorrow.
You know, Barry was the guy who ate steaks and still
yes.
wanted dessert. But Forrest, we played a preseason game up in Seattle at the University of Washington against the New York Giants prior to the Seattle getting a franchise, and the idea was to promote football.
Yeah.
So we had one of those unproductive first halves. I think we had like 8 yards of total offense. So Forrest came in at halftime, and he said, okay, at starting offensive line, you're benched. McKay, so-and-so, 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 Deacon, you're all benched. And you guys were going out and start. And Chuck Hutchinson was the starting left guard next to me at the time. And he was playing against a guy named John Mendenhall. And he goes,
Yeah,
and Hutchinson, you might as well go home and sleep with Mendenhall because he's been screwing you all afternoon.
Oh,
not exactly in those words, but you got the idea. But that was just, you know, that was Forrest. He was, you know, it was as subtle as a punch in the mouth. But we started out 1 year 0-8, and Forrest brought in a guy from Dale Carnegie to talk to us about the power of positive thinking. Unfortunately, we had to play the Raiders, so we started the season 0-9. But in doing so, he had this guy put dollar bills under our cars, and you can do it, put your mind to it, and all this. And he had guys looking under their seats and stuff like that. But, Forrest, he was an interesting guy. But, I guess the year we went 0-9 was Greg Pruitt's first year that he got 1,000 yards. And I'd played every play, and we get ahead towards the 14th game of the season, and so they take me out, and I said, "Whoa! I never blocked for 1,000 yard back." I said, "I'd like to block for them all," and the line coach was Rod Neumannick, and I told him, and he said, "We'll get you back in," and I said, "Okay." So Greg breaks another run. I said, "Hey, Rod," he said, "we'll get you back in." So
you wanted to be there when he reached the 1,000 yard mark.
No, I wanted to block for all 1,000 yards, but now I've kind of been gypped on it. So finally he breaks 1,000 yards. So I go off on the line coach, Rod Neumannick, and I want to kill him on the sideline. So Forrest comes over and says, "What's your problem?" I go, "Hey, I have a piece of you too." And so Forrest let me go for a couple weeks, and he called me in, and he says, "You and I okay?" And I said, "No, we're not." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "No." I said, you take personal pride in what you do, and I had pride in the fact that we were going to have 1,000-yard back. And Forrest later wrote a book, and in the book, that was one of the things he said that he screwed up on, that he misunderstood. And, he's been apologetic to me, and, I appreciate Forrest Gregg.
Well, that's nice to hear. Yeah. Then, so now you bring in Sam Rattigliano.
Yeah.
And different type of personality.
Totally different. And in fact, I had played in the Senior Bowl when I was in college, and they have the coaching staffs from two pro teams. And we had the Denver Broncos, which was Lou Saban, and his receivers coach was Sam Rattigliano. So I got to know Sam before he became the head coach. Unfortunately, when we had passing situations, he'd take me out as a tight end, and he put in a wide receiver, so he kind of ended my pass-catching career. So when he got hired by the Browns, nobody knew who Sam Rattigliano was except for me, and he wasn't on my all-time favorite chart. But Sam was totally different. We talked about Forrest having the curfews on Thursday and Friday nights. Sam had no curfew the night before the game. He let the players stay at home. And basically he said, "I trust you guys, you're going to stay at home." And that worked out till one of the guys, when we played a Monday night game, went and did an appearance on Sunday night, the night before the game, till about 12 o'clock in the morning. So, but Sam was the total opposite. He was more laid back and had a sense of humor to him. And, it was a fun era to play for.
It was also the 1980 Cardiac Kids, what a fun season that was.
Yeah, that was, you know, one of those where, you know, the team chemistry probably created a team that was better than the talent that was on it. But, you know, Brian Sipe had an unbelievable year. He was the league MVP. You know, everybody came up with clutch plays. Dave Logan catches a touchdown pass against the Packers, you know, to win the game. And I think all the games seemed to come down to the wire.
That's right.
Unfortunately, so did the one against the Raiders, which is now known as Red Right 88.
Right. Now, the Browns were many people's favorite to win the Super Bowl that year. Didn't even get to the Super Bowl.
No.
Lost the first game to the wild card Oakland Raiders, who went on to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about that? You know, the call to throw the ball late in the game. Now, to refresh our listeners' memories, Browns lose to the Raiders, what, 14 to 12, was it?
Something like that.
Yes,
yeah.
And there was like 10 degrees below zero. That was the coldest I've ever been in my life.
Well, it was. I think the wind chill factor was 37 below that day. And, you know, playing, if you were running around and sweating, you were okay. But if you were sitting in the stands, you know, God bless those people that sat there for that entire 3 hours because it had to be cold. But what had happened was we'd missed an extra point or so earlier in the game because Paul McDonald was the holder and he had gloves on and he couldn't hold. So rather than kicking a field goal to go ahead.
Yeah, we were down there knocking on the door.
We opted to, you know, throw one more pass and we threw it. And Mike Davis, who was the defensive back for the Raiders, who somebody later found out probably had the worst hands in the history of the NFL, intercepts the pass on a freezing cold day, and that's the end of the season.
Yes. What about the what do you have deep in your heart now about throwing the ball, throwing an interception in that situation in the game, and then with 30 seconds left in the game or so?
Yeah.
Any bitterness, leftover bitterness, anything like that?
No, I never had bitterness because, you know, that's how we got there. I mean, we threw the ball to win it, and in the end, it just, you know, they made a good play and we didn't. And I'll never forget how quiet, you know, that stadium got in such a short period of time. And it got real quiet.
Yes. So then Sam was let go middle of the season in 83, I believe. 84. And Marty Schottenheimer, who had been the defensive coordinator.
He took over.
Yes. And he was a little more of a hard edge guy.
Yeah, he was a little bit more of the old school. But, you know, I only played half a year for Marty. And
that was your last year.
That was my last year. And, you know, like most new coaches, you know, you want to buy time. So they were going to get a new quarterback. In the draft, Bernie Kosar, and they decided that, you know, might as well get a new left tackle at the same time. Right. And I think the gas tank was empty, but, you know, you never want to admit it.
Okay. You had then, you immediately went into the broadcasting booth.
You know, life now is all about timing. And I was very fortunate that when I came to the Browns, Dick Schaffraff had ran 60 miles from Worcester to Cleveland and had no legs when I got here. And I was very fortunate that when I retired from the Browns, Gibb Shanley decided that he wanted to be a sportscaster in California, which opened up a job in the radio booth. And Gibb was probably the one guy that when he used to do interviews with him, he'd say, hey, what are you going to do when you get done with football? You ever thought about going in this business? Well, I never thought about, you know, getting done with football. And so when the time came, all of a sudden I'm thinking, you know, what should I do? And so I ended up, you know, doing the radio. And I've been very fortunate to work with, you know, three great play-by-play guys. Actually four, you know, Jim Mueller, Neb Chandler, Casey Coleman, and now Jim Donovan.
How long are you going to continue? Now, this is, you're now 65 years old.
Yeah.
And this is the year 2014. What are your plans, your broadcasting career? How long are you going to go?
Probably like my playing career. I'll have them throw me out.
Okay. What about so many thrills in the the Browns came so close to the Super Bowl in the 80s. Now, Could you get as emotionally involved in those games as a broadcaster as you did as a player?
I find when things aren't going well, I get quiet. When things are going well, I'm laughing and having a good time doing the broadcast. I go back to the drive and the ball that Elway threw that went right through Big Daddy's hands. You had the fumble game. Unfortunately, for Ernest Biner, people remember him as the guy that fumbled, but they don't remember him as the guy that really got him back into that football game. Then you had the double overtime game against the Jets, which was one probably the more exciting games. Since they've come back in '99, it's been a little tough, because you get to know the guys, on the team, and they become your friends, and you want to see them have the fun. And I think, having gone through, that '80 season, that cardiac kid season. Just to know how the city of Cleveland responds to a team that wins. I would just hope that, any ball player puts on a Browns orange helmet gets that experience because it's special.
That's right. That special 1980 season, that's what everybody, when the old timers make appearances or get together, everybody wants to talk about that 1980 season. There were songs written about you guys. The town was absolutely going crazy. It approached that in the late 80s, but 1980 might have been the pinnacle of Brown's frenzy in this town.
Yeah, I think the 80, they only had the one song, the 12 Days of a Cleveland Brown Christmas, and I was real happy that I was blocking and not holding in it. But then, later on, every musician had a song every time, with Bernie or Strock Around the Clock. Wow. But that's one of the great things about winning in Cleveland. I mean, they enjoy the experience with the fans, and you can't say enough for their endurance. I mean, they've weathered a lot of tough Sundays down on the lakefront.
You've had a charmed life here in Cleveland.
Never had a job. I'm 65 and I've never had a job. I got to play, and I'm doing something that really it's a pleasure to do. So it's not really work.
There were many humorous little moments in your life. One was you bet the Browns general manager Peter Hadhazy. You got him to a bet, or how was it, a $500 figure was involved that you would catch a touchdown pass. That just someday you would have that opportunity, okay? And it came to fruition. Would you cover that?
Well, I'd always, having been a tight end, left the University of Illinois as their second all-time leading receiver, which is an indictment on their passing game. But you didn't throw the ball much back then. But I always felt I could catch it, and they threw a fake field goal in the. Exhibition game, Mark Miller threw me a touchdown pass. But anyhow,
that count or not?
No, it didn't count. But then we were playing the Houston Oilers, and I'm just going to take a guess, it was October 20th, 1983. But we had another fake field goal, and it was right before halftime. And the play was designed that Paul McDonald was going to throw it to Matt Barr, the kicker, out in the flat, and get the first down, and you keep it. Well, became so wide open with my blazing speed that even Paul McDonald couldn't miss me, and so I caught a 14-yard touchdown pass, which means that I've never dropped as many passes as Ozzie Newsome, and my catch ratio is one catch per touchdown.
Very good. What about your best friends from your playing career? I know that you're a business partner of Robert Jackson.
Yeah, I was a business partner. I am currently a business partner of Robert Jackson, but I was a business partner of Gene Hickerson, okay, too. Gene and I were in the soaking pit cover business, and it was called B&H Incorporated.
Yeah, that was a steel product.
Soaking pit covers that were to heat up the ingots, okay, and the iron would warp. Well, we made them out of cast iron. And
company, for the steel industry, mills, huh?
Yeah, so the name of the company was D&H Incorporated, and so we went over to Aliquippa one day.
For Deacon Hickerson.
Yeah. Yes. And so Gene and I go over there, and Gene's the salesman, so he's talking to the guy, and the guy says, well, how come it's not H&D? Everybody knows you, Gene. Not many people know Deacon. Gene looks at the guy, and he says, you know what they say? When you go bankrupt, they always come after the first name. So the name of our insurance company is Jackson Deacon. But no, the guys on the offensive line, you know, the two guys I played next to the majority of my career, Gene Hickerson and Robert Jackson, couldn't find better people. And totally different in a lot of ways, where Gene was just a natural athlete, where Robert was the cerebral guy that always I was able to outsmart other people. But, you know, very fortunate. You couldn't find better people to play next to in regards to getting their job done. They made me look good.
Back in your playing days, a lot of the guys chose to stay in Cleveland. Robert Jackson, you, so many others. You've been in that house on the lake in Bay Village for a lot of years. How many? 35, 40 years?
Going a little over 30 at least. Really? I moved in at 79. So it's one of those that, you know, I get a chance, I look out my back door, I can see the stadium from afar when at night with the lights on. So it's not a bad view.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how about your broadcasting partners? A comment on them, would you? Of course, Shanley, you knew.
Yeah.
He was a great broadcaster.
Yeah, but Gibb left, and that's where I got in, and I started with Nev and Jim. And the first year, they alternated quarters. But
That was Nev and Jim Mueller.
Yeah.
Nev Chandler and Jim Mueller.
Yeah, and that lasted a year, and then Nev became the play-by-play guy, and Jim was the color guy, and I was the analyst. And then there was Nev was the play-by-play guy, and I was the color analyst, and Jim was the locker room guy. Nev was interesting. You know, Belichick would be running a play, and
that would be the Browns coach, Bill Belichick.
Early 90s, and he'd send Metcalf up the middle. And he goes, Metcalf up the middle for 1 yard. Okay, I'm going to take a break. We'll be right back. Jesus, Cramie, what the heck is Belichick running him up the middle? Like, geez, doesn't he know the guy's not going to get... Hey, we're right back, and what a great call by Coach Belichick. And the other one, he'd go, we'd take a break, and he'd go, hey, what do you think they're going to do here? I said, well, it'd be a great time for a draw. So we'd come back on the air, and they would go, hey, Dick, it's a great time for a draw. What do you think? And so then I worked with Casey after Nev passed away, and Casey was totally different. He was tried to broadcast a lot like his father, and was a little more laid back. Mm-hmm. And then after Casey unfortunately passed away, the Browns left, and I got paired with Jim Donovan, and Jim is he's as good as there is.
The Browns have had some really great play-by-play announcers prior to Shanley. They had great announcers, too. I can remember hearing all of them at one time or another. Okay, Doug, the Browns have been going through tough times for the last 15 years. What do you see at the end of the tunnel? Is that the oncoming train, or is that light?
Well, I always like to see it light. And I think, as a player, if you don't think positive, it ain't going to be positive. Mm-hmm. So I've always felt that, the better days are ahead. I think, continuity has a lot to do with success. And, obviously it's drafting good people, but then, once you get them drafted, you have to have team chemistry because, chemistry can take an average team and make it good and take a good team and make it great. And, we talked about the cardiac kids, and whether we overachieved or we achieved that year, I think a big part of it was the chemistry.
Okay, Doug, thanks for joining us here on the Cleveland Public Library's archives. People will enjoy it when they tune in and listen to you.
Well, let's hope so.
Thank you.